Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:20 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 29th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would draw your attention today to this graphic from back in March, where it very clearly highlights that across all age brackets that the mortality rate from COVID-19 was significantly larger than it for the common flu. So obviously there's a massive difference between the people that are over 65 years old and 80 plus year old people. But even in the younger generations, 0.2 is still 20 times higher than 0.01. And that was the best knowledge that was available just over 2 months ago. But what we've seen over the course of the last week has been that the CDC has greatly reduced its estimate of what the actual mortality rate is from the coronavirus. Instead of being at 20 to 40 times more than the seasonal flu, they now think it's perhaps more like 0.04 relative to 0.1. In other words, the mortality rate estimate has been reduced by anything up to 90%. And that raises big questions, because do we really need to have lockdowns when the mortality rate is that low overall? What should we instead be focusing all of our attention and additional resources on protecting the people that are most at risk, which are elderly people, and particularly those in nursing homes, because they not only reside in facilities crowded with people who share similar conditions, but also they have comorbidities. Often people have heart disease, or they have diabetes or high blood pressure, or a combination of these factors which inhibits their ability to combat the virus. Is there truly then a rationale for imposing travel bans, for telling people that they can't go to school, or to telling schools that they have to segregate children, and that instead of having 20 kids in the class, they can now only have 12? What are they then supposed to do? Are they going to have staggered days, that instead of the school year being 5 days a week for every child, is it going to be 2.5 days, or 2 days this week, 3 days next week? All of these are massive questions. And they're being taken very seriously today because there's been a lot of time and planning gone on over the last few weeks to deal with data that is now out of date. Because all of these kinds of decisions are now being made based upon conclusions that were reached in March. But now we have new data, and that should contribute to new types of decisions. Well, I think that's one of the most relevant considerations, because when we then think about what's going on in terms of the stock market, we can see clearly that we've had a significant rebound off the lows in March. And the S&P 500 now is back in the region of 3,000, and we've had a really very significant improvement in sentiment to go with it, so that people are now starting to think about that this was just a medium-term correction, and that there is still potential for additional upside. One of the clearest reasons for believing that is because of the massive infusions of liquidity. And central bank balance sheets have surged by in excess of $4 trillion over the space of the last 3 months, up now to $24.2 trillion from $24 trillion last week. Japan, in here this week, announced a $1 trillion stimulus package that has helped to support the Nikkei. It is now squarely back above the 20,000 level, but I think it's important to highlight that the Nikkei has a somewhat different pattern to other indices. What we are presented with here is a very significant bear market all the way down from the peak in the late 1980s. Then there was a clear succession of occasions where every time it went to got back up towards 20,000, it fell and made a new low. That consistency of the bear market ended in 2016. It got up to 20,000 and hit a higher reaction low by finding support around 15,000. And now it is back above the 20,000 level, with the exception of the significant decline that we've seen. There is the potential here that this is a big first step above the base, or mostly above the base, for the Nikkei, and the failed downside break below 20,000 is potentially confirmatory evidence that support is coming back in. Of course, that is completely contingent on the lows holding. And I do think we are approaching a point where there is scope for some pause and consolidation, but a trillion in stimulus is certainly something that can help to buy additional upside on any stock market. Then, of course, we have before we move on to Europe, I think it is particularly relevant to also highlight the Taiwanese market, because when we then think about that, and over the course of a particularly lengthy period of time, it has been ranging below 10,000 for about 30 years, and then broke above it in 2017 and bounced from the region of the trend mean and is now back above the 10,000 level. So this also looks like an impending first step above the base. It's also, I think, particularly relevant to highlight that there is commonality between both Japan and Taiwan, in that they also had spectacular bull markets in the late 1980s, and arguably Taiwan's was bigger than Japan's, and they have both been confined to very volatile trading ranges for a prolonged period. And now Taiwan is also demonstrating support above a significant lengthy base formation. So that is at least helping to give us some confirmatory evidence that despite the massive challenges represented by the coronavirus, the lockdowns, the global recession, that some markets are doing better than others. Then we really should look at Europe, because they also had a very significant announcement in here this week. The stock market has rebounded and it was in positive territory for most of the week. It is now still, if we look at the very long-term chart, in this very prolonged range, which has been prone to acute bouts of volatility. It is still below the trend mean. It is in the region of the lows put in back in 2018. This has been a really very significant ranging phase over the course of the last 5 years. And Europe has got work to do. I think one thing that we have seen over the course of the last week has been an ability of European markets to rally at the same time as the euro. Now, what that suggests is that investors are beginning to think about Europe as a potential investment destination. On the one hand, there is the realization that valuations in the US have increased substantially, and that there is a significant discount available in terms of valuations based upon Europe. The reason, of course, is because of the incredible uncertainty that's attached to Europe. But if they can get a handle on some of their systemic risks, then that is potentially something that will be rewarding for investors. Well, Europe has announced a $750 billion stimulus, and the big difference is that despite the fact that they're going to print that money, the the euro is stronger because of a returning confidence, it's completely different to what happened in 2012. During the sovereign wealth crisis, the most affected countries where private sector debts were quickly going bad, that was putting a great deal of almost existential pressure on pension funds in creditor nations. The entire rescue operation was based upon forcing peripheral governments to take on the debts of their financial sector. They were being accused of not having sufficient regulatory rules in place to avoid egregious behavior, and essentially the entire populations of those countries had to bear the malinvestment results. Well, that has created deflation. It's been a massive weight on improving standards of living in the Eurozone for the last decade. It has resulted in a great deal of negative attitudes and the growth of populism in the region, and a massive divergence between the winners and losers from the arrangement. The fact that this occasion is completely different in that both France and Germany are willing to sign up to what are effectively transfers from richer nations to poorer nations. That is a condition for federalism. And obviously, there are additional conditions that will have to be met. When we look at the piecemeal way in which the Eurozone has approached federalism, we now have a common currency. There is the European Investment Bank, the European Court of Justice, the European Parliament, the European Commission. So there are some political and financial and legal federal institutions. Now what we need to see is a federalization of the debt burdens, and that is a very significant step. It would be it would be the kind of catalyst that would create a United States of Europe, which is really the only benign potential outcome that could that anyone could really kind of contend that that's something that Europe could achieve, because the status quo is unsustainable. The austerity does not work. The only way that a country can institute austerity is when they have control of their own currency. And none of the Eurozone countries have that. The euro is, in fact, the Deutschmark. And that is abundantly clear when we look at lots of data. Because going back before 1998, they've just simply filled in the Deutschmark. So the euro is the Deutschmark. Anyone who thinks that Germany is going to leave the euro, that's impossible, because the euro is the Deutschmark. The reality is that Germany has been able to cobble together a federalism where it is by far the most significant member. And that has created a market for its goods and services, and that is something that there is just no way they're going to give up. The question is, what are they willing to pay for it? And this remains the big question. But it is worth reminding ourselves that over the course of the last 35 years, there have really been very few occasions where the euro traded below parity relative to the dollar. So that, I think, is a potential near-term or even medium-term bullish phenomenon for the euro. If investors are willing to bet that Europe is on the cusp of moving towards further integration and therefore blunting the populist revolt, then that should be positive for the sector generally. There are, of course, some sectors are going to do better than others. The oil sector is obviously something that is going to be difficult because of the secular bear market. The consumer is also going to be heavily impacted by the coronavirus and by the lack of growth. But then its export sector is certainly something that should continue to benefit, and that has classically been the outperforming sector within Europe, and particularly luxury goods. We certainly saw some of that this week with Hermes. And sorry, I didn't type that particularly effectively, but it is at a new all-time high. And it improved upon that performance again in here today. And this remains one of the more consistent trends, although there are occasions when it does trade below its trend mean. We have certainly got a relatively small number of companies that are trading at new all-time highs. So that is, I think, an important consideration. But a lot of this is driven by the continued provision of liquidity. The Federal Reserve no longer publishes M3 data, but it is at new all-time highs, and it has rallied and in an incredibly robust fashion. So not only do we have a trillion from Japan, 750 billion from Europe, but also the actions of the Federal Reserve. On the one hand, they have printed a lot of money. They have bought back 4 trillion worth of bonds. They have been extremely active in the commercial paper market, and they have promised, although they haven't had to act on it, but they've promised to support the bond market. In fact, they've only bought back approximately a couple of billion dollars worth of bonds, despite the fact that we've had a significant rebound in the high yield market. So that definitely helps to instill confidence in investors that the Fed has got their backs. But what it has also done has been able to free up the bond markets so that there has been $1 trillion of issuance in corporate bonds over the course of the last couple of months. They are, well, it is very much an example of the central bank saying that they'll buy it. It's very similar to build it and they will come. The Federal Reserve says they'll buy the bonds. Companies say, fantastic, we'll issue debt. And then investors are eager to buy that debt because they know that it's backstopped by the Federal Reserve. So that has also been an additional source of liquidity for the market. It's very similar to how banks create liquidity, except on this occasion, it has been the corporate sector generally has been able to create this liquidity. So when we start adding together not only the massive amount of money that has been printed by central banks, then we also have the amount of money that is being printed by corporations. Then, on top of that, we have the massive amount of money that is being created by budget deficits. And that is now up to 1.9 trillion. So when we look at all of this money, it's approaching $10 trillion. And that's a massive amount of capital to throw into the global market. When we look at this, is obviously a very significant figure, but another way of looking at it is China is also running a fiscal deficit of anything up to about 11.5%. So that is the second largest economy in the world running a massive fiscal deficit. So there is an extraordinary amount of money has been printed. Now, when we go back and think about how is it that the Nasdaq has been able to push all the way back up into the region of its peak, and it was in additional positive territory in here today. Now, there has certainly been some indecision over the course of the last three sessions. We have had both back and forth trading, but the most bullish factor is that there is a significant amount of liquidity pouring into the market, and it is successive waves of additional liquidity breaking over the market that is helping to support prices overall. Well, this then becomes rather easy to analyze, because as long as we get this continual swell of additional liquidity, it is likely to buoy asset prices. The one thing that we need to be aware of is that the potential is that eventually we're going to have inflation. Now, that is not a risk in the short term. Despite the fact that we've had this massive wall of liquidity pouring into the market, velocity of money is still very low, and investors are not willing to bet that we're going to have a very significant rebound. I do believe that it is the wrong conclusion that to draw from the strength in stock markets that investors are suddenly willing to believe that we're going to have a V-shaped economic recovery. I think it's perhaps the opposite. Investors are betting that we're going to have a U-shaped economic recovery, and therefore that central banks are more likely to have to continue to provide liquidity as a result, which will therefore inflate asset prices in exactly the same way that it has done over the course of the last 12 years, and therefore that's a reason to buy. That at least makes sense to me, rather than people thinking that we're suddenly going to have a massive return to growth. And in fact, I think if we are going to see that the improving mortality data, the awareness that certain segments of society are much more susceptible to infection than others, and that resources would be more effectively utilized in protecting those people rather than curtailing the activities of everyone else, well, that should help to restart economic activity. But there has been such an enormous damage done to confidence that people are going to want to see some evidence of other people not contracting the disease, of people of effective treatments coming through, of case numbers starting to continuing to decline. The one thing that I think is important to monitor is the 30-year yield, because if it sustains a move above 2%, then we are certainly back in an inflationary environment. Now, it hasn't yet been able to sustain a move above 1.5%, so we're not there yet. And this is something we need to monitor. But the reality is that this massive infusion of liquidity has also created a much wider differential between the haves and the have-nots, because the people with assets and the people with generally the better educated people who have the opportunity to work from home also have their own home. They could naturally socially distance if they wish to. They are in a much better position because they have not experienced the diminution in their earning capacity, but they are spending less, so savings are improving, which is obviously also a factor in supporting the stock market, because people with assets tend to be those that are most active in investments, but it compares very unfavorably with people who are wholly dependent on discretionary services like restaurants or like sporting events or theaters for their income, and or for gyms for that matter. And now those people also tend to live in more cramped conditions. They live in places that have got greater population density. They are more likely to live in multi-generational households. They're therefore much more susceptible to infection and also to loss of wages and also loss of even the potential to make money. So this massive divergence in living standards is a very significant threat to social cohesion. And it is now starting to see some evidence of protest movements evolving, particularly in the USA. There have been three police killings of black individuals in the USA over the course of the last 2 months, and with the publicity, or I guess the publicity that they're receiving, and videos of the crimes and events starting to come forward, then this is creating protest movements. It's creating riots, looting, and additional shootings. These are symptoms of the frustration that large numbers of people feel. And again, that is a wider symptom of the inequality that quantitative easing breeds. So there are very significant factors that the coronavirus takes everything that we were worried about last year and just makes it worse. So inequality was certainly something that people have been worried about over the last few years, and it makes it worse. There was a significant issue about the auto loan delinquencies when we were looking at this last year. It was one of the things that stood out, that there was a lot of delinquencies rising in terms of auto loans. Well, that is likely to multiply in the next time that it is updated. So that is again another thing that was bad last year. It's going to be worse this year. When we think about the home building sector, well, it was doing rather well, and it has rebounded over the course of the last couple of days. The potential here is that with home prices remaining quite stable relative to automobile prices, for example, that people will be looking for bigger houses because they have been staying at home for longer periods than they've ever had to do before. And they're going to feel like that they have the savings built up and that they deserve a better condition of living. Then that should help to support the home building sector overall. When we then think about what is the likelihood that this policy of modern monetary theory is going to be rolled back, I think it's zero. Because this inequality that we have seen being a problem over the last 3 or 4 years is only going to become worse. There is a clear need to give people what they want, which is more money. And this, I thought, was a particularly interesting chart. It's the cost of wages and salaries, or the employment cost index, has been trending downwards for 35 years, and it is quite likely that it is going to trend down again during this particular event. One thing that I thought was interesting is that Facebook has said that they want more people to work from home, but that if they move out of the Bay Area near San Francisco, that they're going to get paid less. So that's a significant factor, that they are looking to lower their wages. Amazon has also said that the additional $2 per hour that they've been paying people for danger pay is going to get taken away. So what that really means is that what we have seen over the course of the last while, where the average hourly earnings for all employees has surged higher just over the course of the last month, this is an artificial blip. It is extremely unlikely to be sustained, and that we're going to see wages coming back down because there are going to be plenty of people unemployed. And if someone working is, and in fact, the reality is that one of the reasons why social unrest has been kept at bay is because, in many respects, people who are unemployed are actually making more money than if they were working. And that is a perverse situation. In fact, the USA is now talking about paying people to go back to work, giving them a $450 bonus if they'll take a job, which is a really quite incredible scenario. Now, of course, there is another way of achieving this, and it is that when the CARES Act expires in the middle of July, that it will not be renewed, and unemployment benefits are going to take a turn downwards. That would have to then encourage people to go out and look for work, but they're not going to be able to do that unless the lockdowns are over. So we can anticipate that lockdowns are going to be gone by the middle of July in the USA and probably everywhere else as well. This is very similar to the kind of lesson that China learned, that the medicine is worse than the disease. And China had to end its lockdowns. Now, they have still got 100 million people under lockdown in the northeast because of an outbreak of the virus up there, but they are trying to get people to get back into the normal rhythm of life in the rest of the country. Now, the one thing that will help to support confidence will be the delivery of a vaccine. Now, the one thing that I think is particularly relevant is when we look at the consistency of trends, that ranges are explosions waiting to happen. The fact that both Japan and Taiwan have got more impressive, more attractive chart patterns than Europe is a reflection of the more benign economic environment and recovery potential that they represent. And it also recognizes the fact that Europe still has a long way to go before it can really have a convincing argument, although we may yet really be in the very early days of recovery and renewal. When we look at the performance of the Nasdaq, it continues to be among the best performers, and it has rallied incredibly impressively. Of course, it is being extremely concentrated in a small number of shares, and the FANGs have recovered their entire decline and are back again at a new all-time high. Now, it is worth considering that this is an equal-weighted index. So it is reweighted, I think, on a monthly basis. So therefore, it is just these 10 stocks that have been among the best performers. But there is also the question about what the influence of the increasing geopolitical tension between the USA and China is going to have. Alibaba has continued to hold the region of its trend mean, which is benign. When we look at some of the social media properties in China, then Dianping has been particularly, our Meituan Dianping has been particularly strong, and it was in additional positive territory in here today. It's also an organ for the Communist Party, and there is the this is obviously one of the clear success stories within the region. Then, when we think about Microsoft, it has had a phenomenal advance. It is right back in the region of its peak, and It has done really very impressively since breaking out of its own lengthy base formation when it adopted the subscription business model back in 2014 and 15, and it is still rising. So these are really quite significant developments. There are a comparatively small number of shares that are close to new all-time highs, and this does look like a reasonably consistent trend. But something I want to turn my attention to over the course of the last decade, it has been the FANGs have done spectacularly well. In the 1960s, it was the Nifty 50. In the 1970s, it was gold. In the 80s, it was Japan and Taiwan. In the 90s, it was the NASDAQ. In the 2000s, well, it was crude oil and also arguably gold. And in the 2010s, it has been the NASDAQ again, but this time with a different group of leaders. So now the big question that investors are asking is, what is going to do best in the next decade? Because we are still only halfway through 2020. What will be the sector that will have surprised on the upside and greatly exceeded the forecasts of investors when we get to 2030? Well, we can still see that the significant benefit that some of the mega-cap companies are getting from the coronavirus. But my fear, at least, is that on the one hand, the massive database providers and the cloud companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft, for that matter, they are very dependent on smaller companies. And they have been really quite firm. Despite the fact that Amazon has been going sideways for 2 months, it has certainly helped that it has been able to sustain this move up and out of the lengthy underlying range. But one thing we saw in here today was that Salesforce, which is one of the most impressive of the software providers for cloud services, it announced earnings that were below par. And while most companies have demurred from giving guidance, their guidance was also negative. So I'm very much fearful that despite the benign environment that these companies have in the short term, that what they have in fact done has been to pull forward the sales from 2021, 2022, 2023 into 2020. In much the same way that happened before the Y2K crisis, that never really had the same effect that people were fearful of. And I think that the parallels today with the incredible amount of money that is being spent to defray the issues relating to the coronavirus, it is very similar to what happened with Y2K. At the time, people were terrified that all electronics would stop working on the 1st of January 2000, and that pulled forward massive spending into 1999 to upgrade infrastructure and to spend a great deal on additional technology spending. It was profoundly bullish for companies like Cisco and Intel and Microsoft, which were the FANGs of their day. Well, aren't we getting the same thing today with the cloud, that companies are massively accelerating their use of these types of services like Zoom, for example? Personally, I hate these video conferences. I don't know anyone who enjoys them. And the security issues that are related to the Zoom products in particular, and the fact that they tend to have a lot of lag, is very annoying. and yet it has been something that has prospered enormously from this environment. But how well are they going to do when the lockdowns do end? And that's a big question. I think that there is certainly room for some significant disappointment. The profitability of grocery delivery services is obviously another sector that is going to come under significant pressure. There is obviously then the additional point that some of the restaurant chains are potentially going to go bankrupt. So they really do need things to turn around quickly. When we start to think then about, well, what are the potential sectors that are going to do better? Well, then going back to biotech, it's really quite likely to be one of the sectors that does best in the next decade. For the first thing is that it hasn't been doing anything for the last 5 years. And it's, I think, really worth reminding ourselves that the human genome wasn't sequenced until 2003. So we're only 17 years into a genetic revolution. The technology around it is improving all the time. The range of potential solutions is improving all the time, whether that is in the speed and cost of sequencing, which is declining at an exponential rate, whether it is in editing genes, which is improving all the time. That is certainly helping in terms of the cost of genetic editing, and CRISPR technology is certainly starting to gain the potential, at least, to deliver investment results. So we have the cost of sequencing and the cost of editing going down. Gene therapies are increasingly being used in the oncology sector. And when we think about I just can't seem to type and talk at the same time. I apologize. When we think about oncology, then the number of cancers that we now have treatments for that are reasonably effective, and the mortality rates from cancers have declined significantly over the last decade as a result of genetic therapies. What we are increasingly looking at as a result of the massive amount of investment that is pouring into the vaccine sector because of the coronavirus is that it is primarily genetically focused solutions are coming through. The financial machinations of Moderna are, I think, something that will probably need some scrutiny, but it has at least found near-term support following an almost 50% decline, and it remains the most likely to get a product to market. That is assuming, of course, that they're not being fraudulent in terms of producing their results. But the reality is that the solution that they're providing, which is to insert a protein which has been engineered because they got the genetic identity of the virus in January, is likely to form a product by November. Now, on top of the fact that we have never had a vaccine for a coronavirus, not least because there wasn't really the need and the commercial utility for it, but the fact that it can be done in approximately 9 months to go from conception to commercialization is a phenomenal example of just how quickly all of this technology is coming together. Now, the potential for that is incredibly diverse because historically, pharmaceuticals have concentrated on chronic conditions. What they are currently concentrating on are psychiatric drugs, and they are increasingly trying to buy these smaller healthcare companies because the evolution of one-shot therapeutics is something that is going to radically change the healthcare system over the course of the next decade. There is no one shot for psychiatric drugs. And I remember David always said that whenever you have extra money, you should treat yourself to analysis. He was a big believer in the personal benefits that can be attained from psychoanalysis. But the reality is that there are no drugs to deliver that kind of value. Where there is the potential to deliver drugs is in the massive cost centers that healthcare systems have, most particularly from obesity and Alzheimer's. And those are sectors that could have significant economic effects if they were treated effectively. Then, of course, if we look at the gold sector, strip away for a moment the fact that there are significant macroeconomic factors that are helping to support the gold price, and simply look at the chart. We have a clear base formation that was approximately 7 years in formation, and now we've had a significant breakout. Now, I think it is particularly relevant that gold has led on the upside, and that's quite normal. Gold also had approximately, in this case, a 6 year base formation. It broke out about a year ago and it continues to extend its breakout. It is already at new highs in a whole range of other currencies. And it is worth reminding ourselves that gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies. And rather than, I know that I always start on the left-hand side of this list, so I'll start on the right-hand side. And gold has been doing spectacularly well against just about all currencies. It is at new highs in most of them, barring the exceptions of the USA, the Swiss franc. It hasn't quite yet been able to, well, I was going to say it hasn't broken out yet, but in fact it did it last week. And then when we look at the euro, it's really only in the last 3 months that it has been able to push on. So when we then think about, well, when are we going to see a new bull market in gold? In fact, the reality is the only place that you do not have a significant new bull market in gold is in US dollars. So that's a very significant factor because the dollar broke down this week. And it is now back below the trend mean. Now it was steadier in here today and it is a little oversold in the short term. But the reality is that if the problems that are outstanding in the rest of the world tend to get better, there is less need to own the US dollar. So there is the potential that gold is going to get an additional tailwind from the weakness of the dollar. And considering the size of the deficits, the size of the national debt, and the potential that some of the other countries in the world are going to have a better return to growth trajectory, then the need to continue to hold dollars is certainly in question. One thing that I think is worth thinking about is when we look at the gold-silver ratio. And this, I think, is something that many people don't seem to appreciate because silver is high beta gold. But what we've seen over the course of the last couple of, well, really over the last decade, is that it takes a while for investors to really get the message that we're in a new gold bull market. So, for example, silver was still trending down against gold all the way between 2000 and 2003. And then silver outperformed all the way to about 2006. Then silver underperformed into the end of 2008 and massively outperformed to its peak in 2011. And then it underperformed. And it has underperformed in a really quite significant fashion, except for the very brief period in early 2016 until now. Now, the most important thing is that gold has broken out already. And if gold continues to hold its breakout, silver is likely to outperform. And silver has not yet been able to complete its base formation. So we've seen gold has broken out, and we've seen that gold shares have broken out. But silver prices, and they were up 50 cents in here today, are now pushing back up towards the upper side of the base formation. And now the big question is whether it is going to fail at the upper side of the base again, or is it going to break on the upside? Personally, I think it is more likely that it is going to break on the upside. And that is then likely to transfer down to platinum. Well, platinum prices have been pausing here in the region of the trend mean. They've also posted a failed downside break from the evolving base formation, but it's going to require a sustained move above 1,000 in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And it is also worth reminding ourselves that platinum peaked at $2,200. So today, it's still at only a fraction of that level. And in fact, the price today is approximating the lows put in 2008 following a really quite incredible crash. Well, to me at least, it seems to be quite clear that gold is likely to be one of the best performing assets between now and 2030. There is the clear potential that biotech is going to be a sector that is going to perform spectacularly well over the next decade. We also know that the potential for technological innovation is really quite acute, that there is the clear potential that battery technology is going to have a step change at some point in the next 5 years, that there will be a new type of battery chemistry delivered that will double the range of current electric vehicles. Tesla is in the process of commercializing a million-mile battery. Well, that then removes one of the biggest challenges for the electric industry, which was the electric car industry, which was the loss of value in electric cars because the battery was exhausted after a couple of years and had to be replaced, and that represented almost the full cost of the vehicle. So they had no ability, anyone who bought one had no ability to get rid of it in a profitable or at least in an efficient manner. A million-mile battery solves that problem. A battery that delivers double the range of current batteries will completely erode any potential for range anxiety. Then we have the issue about how is the electricity to drive this fleet of electric vehicles going to be generated? Well, it's quite likely we're going to have a massive infrastructure build globally as a result of the massive amount of money that's been printed and the clear intention to try and repair economies from the coronavirus lockdown induced recessions. So there's likely to be a massive new infrastructure build. And there couldn't be a better time to start doing it because commodities have not been this low in years. So there is obviously a clear use case for commodities to evolve from here. So when we start to think about what is likely to benefit in the next decade, then we can come up with some pretty good contenders. The big question is about geopolitical tension. China represents a clear threat to the global liberal order. They are intent on exporting their version of national socialism internationally. And that is something that is going to have to be resisted. It does mean that there is going to be a greater focus on automation. There's going to be a greater focus on nearshoring, on less reliance on an international global supply chain network. That is potentially something that is disruptive, is likely to have an inflationary impact. The potential use cases for additional commodity use, and coupled with the inflationary sparks that are being created as a result of modern monetary theory, that does suggest that there is risk in the government bond markets, that there is potential we are going to have an inflationary outcome, although there isn't yet evidence that is in fact the case. One thing also that is worth considering from a technological perspective is that private enterprise has succeeded in beating government-funded projects to the prize of attainment and commercialization of new technologies. That was true of the Human Genome Project in the early 2000s, when Craig Venter said that he could do it faster and cheaper, and he did it faster and did it $300 million cheaper than the government-funded project. The space sector has historically been the preserve of governments and their contractors, who had no incentive to speed up, to come in under budget, or to, in fact, even attain their goals in a timely manner. But Elon Musk has been able to demonstrate that reusable rockets is possible, that reducing lift costs is possible, and if everything goes according to plan tomorrow, that private enterprise is effective at providing a cheap and reliable solution to lifting humans into space. Just this year, Japan was the first country, and their team was able to mine an asteroid and return the payload to Earth. Now, that was a very small payload, but it was a proof of concept effort that it's possible. Well, that means that we are now in the era of space mining. We're in the era of much greater space traffic, and eventually we're going to be an interplanetary species. This is also something that is potentially possible within the next decade because of the role of private enterprise superseding the efforts of government. Governments are really very good at seeding the stake, at creating the opportunity, and then generally it has been private enterprise has come through with faster, efficient solutions. And I'm very much of the opinion that we're going to see a similar condition evolve in fusion. The ITER project is not due to have first ignition until 2035. But since it was initially considered, superconductor technology has improved beyond recognition. What happened with a team at MIT, which is another fantastic example of what happens when a commercial opportunity arises, is that the particle physics team lost their funding. They had been playing with the university's tokamak reactor for years without really coming up with any solutions. So they had their funding cut, and within 6 months they had a prototype design that instead of filling a stadium could fit on the back of a truck, and are secured $78 million this week, not least from Temasek in Singapore, to build that reactor. Now, they have so far raised $200 million. They anticipate needing $450 million to build their first prototype. Relative to the $12 billion that has been spent to build the ITER project to date, and probably multiples of that before the project is eventually, in fact, finished. On top of that, there are at least 20 other fusion startups all racing to get to the same prize of clean, renewable, and massive quantities of energy. And this is also something I anticipate seeing realized by the end of this decade. So there is the clear potential that in the coming decade, we're going to see more geopolitical tensions. We're going to see more commodity demand as a result of infrastructure development, and potentially development of vehicles for war. We're also likely to see massive innovation in the biotechnology sector. And since paying for all of that is going to require a significant amount of capital, that this evolution of modern monetary theory is likely to continue to represent a significant tailwind for the precious metals sector. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.